Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Young people aging out of foster care are especially vulnerable to hunger, unemployment, and homelessness during the pandemic. We'll talk about some new research out of Penn. And is there reason to hope for Eagles fans? The Birds got their first win last night and are first in the NFC East. But to start, a nightmarish scenario has begun to play out in the nation's airline industry. Airlines began furloughing tens of thousands of workers last week after federal pandemic relief money ran out. Over 1,400 have lost their jobs, at least temporarily, at Philadelphia International Airport. Airlines are lobbying for more money to keep workers on the payroll at least through March. And they say if they get it, furloughs might be reversed. Congress and the White House are attempting to find common ground on relief extension, but as uncertainty persists, airlines and related industries continue to suffer near catastrophic losses. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has been reporting on this, along with Miles Bryan for Keystone Crossroads. And Laura joins us now to bring us the latest, especially as it affects our listening area. Hi, Laura.
Good morning, Mary.
So over 1,400 airline workers at Philly International are off the job, at least for the moment, or they're seeing significant cuts in hours. What sort of positions are we talking about?
We're talking about pilots, flight attendants, fleet services, mechanics, employees who work directly for airline companies, because those are the companies that are now shedding workers because they just don't have that federal relief that they had since March.
Which airlines have been hit the hardest?
So Philadelphia International Airport is an American Airlines hub, and so it's by far the biggest carrier out of Philadelphia. And as a result, they've also had the biggest number of furloughs. The company didn't share directly how many people from each job category they were furloughing, but their respective unions did. So American was looking at furloughing 273 pilots, 740 flight attendants, all based in Philadelphia, along with 337 fleet service folks and mechanics, the people who take care of the planes. And that's all according to the different unions that represent those different job categories. And then there were some furloughs, much smaller, in the dozens, not hundreds, from some of the airlines that do service PHL Airport, but don't have the numbers that American does. So United furloughed around 75 people, a couple smaller airlines, one called PSA, one called Republic, furloughed in the dozens themselves. But it's not clear if there were others or a handful more layoffs here and there.
Yeah, well, suffice it to say, an especially big blow to American Airlines workers at Philadelphia International. What did American Airlines Chief Doug Parker have to say about this?
So he's been lobbying very hard. He's been out in front trying to get relief for his workforce. But, you know, the last day of September, he did write a letter that was sent to all American Airlines employees saying he was very sorry, but without another relief package from the federal government, he couldn't move forward with keeping people employed. So they did initiate furloughing 19,000 people across the country. At the same time, Parker left a door open, a kind of lifeline there, saying, you know, in the event that the White House and Congress do reach an agreement within a few days, how long that time frame is, isn't exactly clear, that the company would reverse course and recall those furloughed workers.
So you and Miles spoke with a number of furloughed workers at Philadelphia International Airport, including flight attendant Yusef Ortolaza, who told you, Laura, news of the furlough was almost like news that somebody had died. Tell us more about that.
That's right. Ortolaza has been working as a flight attendant for about 7 years, and I think he described this feeling of, you know, the furloughs weren't surprising. They were announced in July, but everyone hoped they weren't going to happen. And so the fact that they did actually go through, that Congress and the White House were unable to come together and pass a package, you know, he sort of was talking about the stages of grief, and he was in the sort of disbelief or denial stage initially because he didn't want to lose his job.
You know, and he was one of those folks who was able to work almost any aspect of the flight attendant job. As you reported, he's a polyglot. He speaks a fair number of languages, which is obviously useful if you're doing transatlantic flights. One reason he'd gotten into the business was because of the perception of job security. And as you write, his union contract includes the right of recall, meaning he could be offered his job again if it returns.
That's correct. And It is a pretty stable field. There are a lot of unionized positions in the airlines. So even though he's furloughed, he's receiving some money. So it's not an abrupt cutoff because he has enough seniority in the company to get a little bit of money to keep going for a few more months. And there is some language, he said, in his contract that would allow him to get his job back in the event that American is reconstituted and is flying again. That's not a guarantee. And as he said, you know, a lot of people stay for 50 years. It's seen as a very stable career, but not when the entire travel and tourism industry just grinds to a halt.
Sure. Worth mentioning, too, you know, just overall of Philly International, the airport apparently reported an all-time high of 33 million airplane passengers last year, so an enormously productive time for the airport in 2019 before everything, of course, came to a halt this year. So here's the latest, as I understand it, on negotiations in Congress for broad COVID-19 relief. The House has passed a $2.2 trillion plan. The White House proposal is for just over $1.5 trillion, which includes, I think, about $20 billion for airlines. What sort of lobbying on behalf of the airline industry is happening behind the scenes? Do you have a sense of what might be going on?
I could tell you what I know. I know that earlier in the year, airline CEOs met with the White House to plead their case directly, and they've told me that they're pressuring individual lawmakers. So, for example, there was a protest outside of Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey's office earlier this year. And as of Friday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi did issue a statement pleading with the airline companies, saying, please don't go through with these furloughs. I would like to try doing a standalone airline relief package outside of the sort of fuller $2.2 trillion package you're talking about, because that one's just harder to get through. Those two sides are much farther apart on what relief for the entire country should look like, but they're pretty close together on what relief for airlines should look like. But it hasn't materialized yet. So we know there's a lot of pressure being flexed behind the scenes, but so far there isn't an agreement.
When you were talking with furloughed workers, did you pick up on a sense of hope that this might be resolved at some point soon?
I think there is hope, but they've also been waiting for this shoe to drop, these furloughs to start for several months. And so I think they're just trying to be realistic, depending on how old they are, what kind of a future they saw in their individual career paths, and just, you know, plan as though they may be in a precarious situation for a while with hope that they won't.
So how will the furloughs likely affect air travel at Philadelphia International Airport?
The furloughs are largely in response to a lack of demand, so it's not as though flights are being cut because of the furloughs. It's that demand just plummeted. And we know from the Philadelphia Tourism Bureau that passenger volume is down 62% as of the end of August over last year. So a lot of international flights just weren't happening for much of the year. So it's less that people won't have the option of flying. There are still some flights. It's just that they couldn't afford to keep people on staff to staff flights that weren't happening.
Got it. You referenced earlier related industries. Tell us more about how this enormous drop in passenger volume has impacted industries that are related to the airline industry.
Yeah, travel and tourism has just been one of the hardest hit across the country and in the Philadelphia region when it comes to unemployment related to COVID. So earlier in the pandemic, we saw large-scale layoffs at hotels, particularly those affiliated with business travel. We saw layoffs in the airport itself. So there's, in addition to the airline companies, there's cleaning companies, there are contractors, there are the kind of retail and food staff in the airport, and a lot of those fields have already gone through massive layoffs or furloughs just as a result of the lack of business, and it's expected to be pretty sticky, particularly in things like hospitality. Projections are that those jobs may not come back fully until 2023, 2024.
Oh, boy. Yeah, just a devastating domino effect. So Visit Philadelphia is the official go-to site for tourists who are traveling the area. Guessing the pandemic has caused a big shift there in marketing strategy.
It's true. I think they've been trying to follow the way people actually want to travel right now. People don't necessarily feel confident that they can safely get on a plane or travel long distances. So they're sticking much closer to home. And as a result, Visit Philadelphia has pivoted its marketing strategy and said they're basically just advertising Philly to places that are a short drive away. They're not advertising Philly all over the world as a destination. They just don't see the use value in doing that right now.
Laura, another airline employee who saw her hours slashed way back is, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Judy Lynn Diet.
You got it.
tell us a bit about her and how she views her industry's future.
Well, Judy's older. She's 61, and she described herself as, you know, not quite old enough to retire, but definitely not in the beginning or middle stages of her career. And she described almost relief at the furloughs happening. She wasn't fully furloughed, but her hours were cut from 40 hours a week to 12. Wow. And so, but just having that certainty that this is happening, this thing I've been afraid of, she described as a relief. But she really loves her industry. She had a really compelling pitch for why working in airlines could be fun. She's a customer service representative. She said there's hustle and bustle and, you know, people from all over the world, and you're problem solving things that you never expected. And comparing that to a desk job, you know, she's just sort of reticent to turn herself over to another field where she just doesn't think she'll be as stimulated or interested.
Okay, well, we'll certainly be keeping an eye on that story. And briefly, Laura, before we let you go, another COVID-related story you reported on recently. ShopVac is closing its doors after over a half century. I believe it's located in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And there is some controversy about the reasons why this longtime business is shutting down.
That's right. ShopVac is sort of synonymous with the product they create. They make wet-dry vacuums and industrial vacuum systems. And they abruptly shut down in the middle of September. They have a manufacturing plant and distribution centers in Williamsport in Lycoming County. And they said it's COVID's fault, and we also blame a kind of mystery buyer who was going to come in and save all your jobs, but they backed out. This was what was in the termination letter. But it emerged through talking to people close to that deal and through talking to employees that this was a Pennsylvania manufacturing company that had had some financial troubles for the last several years, far predating COVID, and that those stated reasons were not the whole story. Basically, this is a company that is completely owned by its creditors. It's owned by the bank JP Morgan, who would not comment for the story that I did. And instead of selling the company, JP Morgan decided they could make more money liquidating its assets. Got it. That's what people familiar with the deal say happened. And the result is more than 400 workers losing their jobs in an area that's already hit pretty hard by pandemic unemployment. And they haven't been given things like health care and severance or other perks that you would expect.
All right. I've got to stop you there. But Laura Benchoff, thank you so much for updating us on these important stories. Great to have you with us once again.
Thank you, Mary.
Laura Benchoff is a WHYY reporter. And coming up, we talk about the hardships facing children who are aging out of foster care during the pandemic. Stay tuned. You are listening to
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Life can be incredibly challenging for a young person aging out of foster care. But for many, the pandemic has made a successful transition to independence nearly impossible. Researchers at the Field Center at the University of Pennsylvania recently surveyed several hundred older youth across the country who were either in foster care or about to leave. And what they found was deeply unsettling, though perhaps not surprising. Access to employment, housing, and food has become even more difficult during the age of COVID for this group of young people. And without the safety net of support from family and friends, a large number of them are exceptionally vulnerable and experiencing anxiety and depression. As one 23-year-old participant said, "I was already broke. Now I feel broken." Johanna Greeson is managing faculty director at the Field Center for Policy Practice and Research at Penn. She is also associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice, and she is co-author of the study. Welcome, Johanna.
Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So to begin, tell us a bit about the Field Center's mission in regards to youth and why you felt this research was necessary.
That's a great question. So the Field Center works on improving systems that children and youth come in contact with, and we really do have an exclusive focus on the child welfare system. And so we engage in advocacy and policy work, and then with the hope that we'll influence practice along the way.
Even without a pandemic, Johanna, older youth in foster care tend to have limited resources. Remind us of the challenges facing them during so-called normal times as they age out of the system.
So they really do experience an array of negative outcomes, and we have excellent research now that's established that over many years. So homelessness, lack of educational progress or attainment, incarceration, mental health issues, substance use issues, the list goes on and on. And so this study really just brought everything to the fore and then intensified the bad things that already are happening.
I'd like to get the number out, 888-477-9499. If a listener would like to contact us, you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. So let's get to the research. For one, a great many older foster youth say COVID-19 has impacted their living situation. Tell us more about that.
So we found that COVID impacted the living situation in that young people were forced to change where they were living. And so this could be thought of as young people having to leave school dorms, foster parents, not being comfortable with the situation anymore, an array of things. And the educational piece to me was particularly concerning in that school can be a protective bubble. And so if you're forced to leave school, then a lot of other negative things end up happening. And I think the living situation finding is just one of those.
Yeah. Was there a sense that a fair number of these young people could end up on the street?
Definitely. We had young people move from being housed to not being housed, or, couch surfing, being unstably housed. And certainly, that could also end up, literally on the street.
And employment for youth in foster care or those transitioning out of it, it's been really hard in that aspect, too. I mean, so many people have been losing work. They're no exception.
That's true. And one of the things that I found interesting about that finding is many of them were engaged in gig work. And we define gig work as, driving for Uber or Lyft or other babysitting, even just otherwise not your typical, full-time or even part-time sort of steady employment. And so, as we all know, that kind of work, especially the driving work, pretty much stopped, or, it was halted for a good number of months.
Were they able to access support from adults who'd be able to point them toward benefits when they lost work?
Go ahead.
I'm not sure whether that was actually part of the survey. I just didn't know what your sense might have been of that.
Some reported that they did feel connected, and I actually thought that number was higher than I was expecting, so that's a little bit of good hope. But also, like a quarter of them reported wishing they had more connections to adults. And so those adults then could do a variety of things, not just help them access benefits, but, potentially give them somewhere to live on a short-term basis, help them with, the array of negative outcomes. But yes, new public benefits, like going from not being on public assistance to needing to apply for it, especially unemployment,
sure.
There was a jump there.
How about access to food? Were some telling you that they were going hungry?
Yes. So we found that about a quarter to a half, we're experiencing some sort of food insecurity. So everything from I'm in a food crisis right now to, you know, I have access to some food. But then, you know, there was a smaller percentage that said, you know, I feel fine with my food situation.
We are speaking with Johanna Greeson, associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Social Policy and Practice, and about a new report, some research coming out of the Field Center at Penn regarding youth who are aging out of foster care and how the pandemic has impacted them negatively. Johanna, as you know, many youth in this survey reported feeling depression or anxiety. One 19-year-old wrote, I get very depressed not being able to visit my siblings who are in a separate foster home. I worry about them and their safety all day. What can agencies do to help alleviate emotional distress for these young people?
So that also is a great question. And we definitely have some recommendations along those lines. Very simply, you know, agencies can be creative about how they support young people in visiting with their siblings or other family, meaning that now that we're all using Zoom and other platforms, the same can be done for young people in foster care. So there's no reason that a young person should feel completely disconnected and, you know, basically consumed with worry about their siblings that are placed somewhere else. So it's just really investing in that infrastructure to be able to provide access to that sort of technology.
Are governments recognizing these issues? And especially concerning is the fact that these young people, many of them seem to be facing mental health challenges during the pandemic without a safety net.
That's right. So I would say some states are doing better than others. I don't think Governor Wolf has done enough, to be honest. There is legislation that, you know, he was asked to consider signing that would provide more protections during disaster times for young people in and aged out of foster care. I don't actually know the status of that other than it hasn't gone anywhere. California is always ahead of the curve on foster care issues. So I know Governor Newsom did sign some legislation that had a positive impact. And I actually think of California as sort of a model state for the rest of us. So if we want to learn some lessons about how to do different things in foster care well, California is a good state to check out.
All right, we've got a caller waiting to express her opinion or a question. Lisa in Glenside, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Hi, thank you. I'm listening to this great discussion and wondering what we as a community can do to help. So, like, I think for myself, for example, I would be delighted to volunteer or maybe be connected to one of these youth that you're talking about, or meet them for lunch once a month, or maybe help them with a job search or interview skills. What are some things that I or we all can do to assist?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you so much, Lisa. So, Johanna?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there are a lot of great direct service organizations in the Philly area. I'll give a shout out right now to Valley Youth House that do great work with this population. I'm not sure about their capacity to take on volunteers specifically, but that would certainly be one place to start. I will say that getting involved in a sort of mentorship relationship with a young person in or aged out of foster care, although it is a great idea on the surface, I don't actually advocate mentoring this vulnerable group in sort of the traditional way where it's a stranger mentor. I advocate that young people who know adults, that those adults be their mentors. And I've done a lot of work in this area in terms of developing an intervention that's designed to support those kinds of relationships. Traditional mentoring has been shown to not be that effective with this group for a variety of reasons, including just sort of the trust issue. But that doesn't mean we can't do something. I would also say that there's a great organization nationally that I sit on the board of, One Simple Wish, and it actually is a wish-granting platform and allows you to have some communication with a young person that you grant a wish for. That's not only in Philadelphia, but they grant wishes all over the country. And so I would say, you know, start with an organization that's trusted and sort of then go from there to see what your involvement can be.
All right. Let's get to reforms that you outline in the report, recommendations anyway. One would be ensure that older youth in foster care stay safe, housed, and connected to services and caring adults. Where does the age of emancipation come into play here during the pandemic? Should that just be set aside?
What's that? What was the question about the age of emancipation?
So as far as ensuring older youth in foster care stay safe, housed, and connected to services, and caring adults, where does the age of emancipation come into play here as the recommendation is concerned? Are you suggesting setting that aside? I think it is, what is it, 23 in Pennsylvania? And just saying, you know, until the pandemic is over, these young people are able to access the services and the housing and et cetera that they'd had?
Exactly. So basically put a moratorium on the concept of aging out while we're in a pandemic. And that should be new policy that goes into effect for any kind of crisis situation like this. And certainly then facilitating connection to caring adults is the other thing that can help in this area.
And again, I think Pennsylvania raised the age limit to 23 for aftercare services for these youth back in the summer, but the state did not agree to a moratorium on aging out during the pandemic, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
And that's part of what, you know, the policy that Governor Wolf has been asked to consider signing into law would make happen.
Another recommendation, expedite opportunities for young people under 21 to re-enter care. So this is a group that has already aged out in some areas. You're saying if they've aged out, they should be able to get back into foster care as a way of staying safe.
Exactly. So they can do that now. It's just that it can take a long time. And so the point there is, how can we make that process move quicker when we're in a crisis like this?
Okay. And back to food, what are some recommendations, again, you know, for making sure these young people are provided for as they're kind of trying to navigate the safety net full of holes during COVID?
Right. So certainly if they are eligible for benefits, you know, for SNAP, which is our food stamp program, certainly getting them signed up for that. Agencies can also just consider direct assistance. And so if there are folks in the community, though, that also want to contribute to that effort, you know, that would be possible. Bags of groceries, gift cards to places like Target, where they can also buy food. So direct assistance in this sort of time should never be overlooked.
All right. We've got another call coming in. Carl in Center City, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Hi.
Hi, Carl.
Hi. So I understand your concerns with not allowing or dissuading people who don't already know the children to mentor.
Yeah.
But I think a problem with saying that people they already know should mentor is that a lot of reasons these kids are in foster care is because, you know, the whole family is in despair and they don't know people of means.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to be a hard call. I mean, that was my experience. I volunteered in foster care for a number of years. And, you know, we would drop the kids off, you know, at their parents' house on some weekends. And, you know, they didn't know anyone of me. So to say, you know, having someone they already know mentor them, that could be a difficulty.
Thank you, Carl, for the call. And good point. It could be a challenge that, you know, one of the reasons sometimes, you know, a young person is in foster care is because their social safety net has broken down among family and friends.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that insight, Carl, definitely. So we do know that about 66% of kids that participated in one of the best outcome surveys following aging out have reported that they feel close to an adult since they were age 14. And so my work has really looked at how can we leverage then those adults that they report feeling close to. And so the intervention I've developed is designed to do that. So it leads a young person through a series of very structured activities to consider and think about the adults they feel close to. And then we work on identifying them and bringing them on board to serve in a, you know, protective capacity and be a resource going forward. But it is a really good point that not every young person will have this kind of adult. And so if they don't, that's certainly when a more formal mentoring relationship can be offered. I just like to always start with the adults that may be in the young person's life, because they're definitely there. We just haven't always done the work to find them.
Johanna, let's get back to mental health for just a moment, and we've only got about 45 sure. seconds left. When you see a response from a young person who says, I was already broke and now I feel broken, what is your reaction? Amazing. This is heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, and I think it just really captures the entire situation that we're in, especially these young people, tremendously effectively. I think that's why my work matters, and it just makes me feel more committed to this population than ever and finding solutions to the outcomes they experience, whether we're in a pandemic or not, but certainly in a pandemic time, being even more focused and wanting to make things better.
Johanna Greeson, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Mary.
All right. Johanna Greeson is associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. Up next on the Roundup, Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Mike Sielski. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the region.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Roundup, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Hard to believe we are already four games into the regular football season, and it has been a roller coaster first stretch for the Philadelphia Eagles. The Birds went into last night's game with two losses and a tie and somehow turned it around, beating the 49ers 25-20. The schedule becomes only more challenging. They face the Steelers next week, and after that, the Ravens. Does this team now have some sort of momentum to make something of the 2020 season? We'll be talking about this, along with the impact COVID is now having on the NFL. Also, the Sixers, Phillies, college football, and we'll take your calls and comments at 888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org is the email, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mike Sielski is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he is here for the rest of the hour. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, we'll start off with your impressions of last night's game. Tell us what you think.
Wow. in some ways, I feel like if anyone was pining for preseason football and was missing those four exhibition games that NFL teams usually play every late summer and early fall, then that's what you got last night. I mean, both the Eagles and the 49ers have been suffering from, you know, a raft of injuries, and you saw a lot of unfamiliar faces out there, a lot of young players for both teams. And I give the Eagles a lot of credit because, you know, they could have gone out there and lost that game and they'd be 0-3-1 and, you know, the entire city would be, you know, moaning and groaning. And instead they went out there and rallied and were able to pull that game out in the fourth quarter. And because their division is so bad, they're actually in first place now with a 1-2-1 record.
I think you call it galactically awful, the NFC East.
Yes.
Weren't those your words today?
Yeah, they were, and it is that. You know, you're looking at a New York Giants team that's 0-4. You're looking at the Washington football team, which is 1-3, and whose only win came in the first game of the season over the Eagles. And then you have the Dallas Cowboys, who are probably the most talented team in the division, and yet they're 1-3 and were one historically bad meltdown by the Atlanta Falcons away from being 0-4 themselves. So this is a bad division, and it's not going to take much for the Eagles to stay in the race all season.
All right. Well, Carson Wentz has taken a lot of heat for the first three games anyway. Last night, good game, certainly not great. You wrote yesterday, Mike, that everybody needs to stop hyperventilating over Carson Wentz. So back off and ease off and let the guy find his rhythm?
Well, I think more to the point, Mary, there have been a number of really good quarterbacks the Eagles have had over the years who have had worse stretches for longer periods of time than Carson Wentz had the first three games of this season. And I think it's kind of a function of our society now and media and a whole bunch of other things that, you know, all we see is right in front of us. We assume history started about 17 minutes ago. So while I understand that people are upset that Carson Wentz is supposed to be a great quarterback and should have been playing better than he had been through the first 3 weeks, the truth is there have been other quarterbacks who were every bit as talented as he was, who have played for the Eagles, who played worse. And, you know, some of the other bigger issues with the team, such as injuries and the poor play of the defense and their poor history of drafting over the last several years, have as much, if not more, to do with why the team got off to such a rocky start.
Yeah.
Than Wentz did.
So a little perspective here. Heroes of the game, if you will, Travis Fulgham and Alex Singleton. I'm not used to saying those names. Who are they?
Neither am I. Well, Alex Singleton, who returned that interception for a touchdown late in the game, and really it turned out to be the difference in the game, has been a practice squad player for the Eagles for the last year or so. Very nice kid, very outgoing and engaging kid, but not somebody who, you know, you would think of as the second coming of Lawrence Taylor or anything like that. But he made a big play for them, obviously, last night, forced into action after another linebacker had gotten injured. And a very similar story for Travis Fulgham, the wide receiver who caught a long touchdown pass from Wentz earlier in the fourth quarter. Again, a practice squad player for a couple of teams over the last year or two. And what's particularly interesting about Fulgham is that he played college football at Old Dominion in Virginia, and he was actually at first not even a scholarship player there. He was recruited as a walk-on, you know, come on and try out for the team, and if you're good enough, maybe you can earn a scholarship. He's had a pretty incredible journey to get to the point where he's catching a touchdown pass on the, you know, on national television on a Sunday night.
Unbelievable. Also a former rugby player, Jordan Mailata. I think I've got that right.
That is correct. Yes, 6'8" tall from Australia, grew up playing rugby. The Eagles actually drafted him in 2018. They took a chance on him late in the draft, hoping that they'd be able to develop him over time to become a left tackle in the NFL, even though he really hadn't played very much football at all. And he actually, with the exception of committing one penalty last night, really played well. And I think that's one of the most encouraging things if you're an Eagles fan, was to see how well Mailata played, because left tackle is the most important position on the offensive line. It protects Carson Wentz's blind side, and Mailata did a very good job.
So injuries are just an ongoing refrain with this team. It seems like forever, Mike. And it also seems like they're making the Eagles a perennial, you know, perennial underdogs, and that might have been fun during the Super Bowl run, but is it getting a little tiresome?
I'm sure if you asked anybody at the NovaCare complex, they'd say it's getting tiresome. The interesting thing, Mary, is that the Eagles have turned over their medical staff year after year after year for the last 3 or 4 years trying to solve this problem, and they're unable to solve it. Now this year may be a little bit of an outlier in that regard because of the pandemic and, you know, its limitations and players are it's not just limited to the Eagles, the problem with injuries this year, because there was no preseason. You know, you're getting more hamstring pulls and groin pulls and groin tears and things like that. But yes, for the Eagles, it's been an ongoing problem for several years now. And, you know, the year they won the Super Bowl, 2017-2018, they had more depth and were able to overcome it. Lately, within the last few years, I mean, it's been a bit more of a struggle to deal with all these veteran players who aren't available to play.
Who's at fault? Is it Howie Roseman?
I think that's part of it, yeah. I mean, you know,
the
like
GM.
I said, they've been trying to get the, you know, the medical situation right for a while. And the other aspect of that, too, is You know, when the Eagles won that Super Bowl, they were full of veteran players. And as you know, with the NFL, there's a salary cap. You can only pay so many players so much money. And it was easier then for the Eagles to pay more money to veteran players in the short term. They could, you know, hold them under the salary cap because at the time, Carson Wentz, their quarterback, wasn't making a lot of money relative to other players at other positions. Well, now they've given Wentz a big contract. They have to draft well to get talented, inexpensive players who can step in and play, and they really haven't done that. Their draft record over the last 3 or 4 years has not been good, and so that's been, you know, a cause of concern and something that's been kind of holding them back as well.
All right, so up next, the Steelers, so far unbeaten. Possible reason for that is that they didn't play yesterday because, you know, we'll talk about COVID in just a moment, but they will be well rested when they meet the Eagles. The Eagles meet them next Sunday. What do the Eagles need to do to prepare for quarterback Ben Roethlisberger and company?
Well, the Steelers are kind of the antithesis in some ways of what the Eagles have been recently. The Steelers always have depth. They always draft well. Roethlisberger has been their quarterback with, you know, he's missed some time last season or the season before with some injury, but he's been there for the Steelers since 2004. He's still a very, very good quarterback, knows how to run that offense. The Steelers have an excellent coach in Mike Tomlin. Again, they're just kind of the, in some ways, you know, they're right up there with the New England Patriots as kind of the model franchise in the NFL for maintaining success. So the Eagles are really going to have their work cut out for them. And you have to start hoping that some of these veteran players who have been missing time start to get back in the lineup because, you know, the Steelers are a better team than the 49ers are. And, you know, as you said, the Eagles are really going to have their work cut out for them next week.
So, again, yesterday's Steelers-Titans game, I guess, was moved back to later this month because of a sizable COVID outbreak on the Titans team. Also, Patriots quarterback Cam Newton is out that game because he's apparently tested positive. That game, the Patriots, and who are they playing? The Chiefs. That's been moved to tonight. Are you surprised it took till week 4 for COVID to make an impact? And what do you see? How do you see this impacting the season over the next few weeks overall in the NFL?
I'm a little surprised that it took this long for, you know, this relatively big outbreak to happen because, you know, these players and these teams are not in a bubble in the way that the NBA set up things in Orlando or the way that the National Hockey League set up things in Toronto at Edmonton. They were in full kind of lockdown, and the NFL has not done that. In terms of what it means for the rest of the season, I think, you know, looking to Major League Baseball is a pretty good example. If you think back to when the games there resumed, the Florida Marlins lost what? Almost half their roster because they had tested positive and had an outbreak here in Philadelphia, or at least that's where they were when the outbreak happened. And here they are in the playoffs playing in the National League Division Series, and the season went on. So I would be very surprised if any, unless, you know, the outbreak doubles or even quintuples, the NFL is committed to getting this season, getting through it and finishing it and doing things as close to normal as they possibly can. Obviously, there have been some adjustments. There's been, you know, games without fans in the stands. If you watched last night's game, you saw Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth on NBC wearing masks and all the coaches and players wearing masks on the sidelines. They're going to take as many precautions as they possibly can to allow them to continue playing the games. And I don't think any outbreak, even like the one we've seen with the Tennessee Titans or Cam Newton and the Patriots, is going to stop the NFL from trying to finish the season.
All right. And just one quick question about Nick Foles, because we love Nick Foles in Philadelphia. He's starting for the Bears. Had a thrilling game, come from behind victory over the Falcons. I think he came into that game late. You know, Colts beat him yesterday, 19-11. But, you know, from what I saw in the red zone, he looked pretty good. I'm not an expert by any stretch. How do you think this is for Foles, starting for the Bears?
Well, I think the Bears are going to get the full Nick Foles experience, which is to say that Nick Foles is the quarterback equivalent of the little girl with the curl. When he's good, he's very good. And when he's bad, he's horrid. And they got a little bit of the latter Foles yesterday. You know, he only put 11 points on the board. You know, the previous week, the Bears got, you know, the Super Bowl Nick Foles, you know, yeah, come back, four touchdowns in the fourth quarter, just incredible. That's who Foles has been throughout his career, and it just so happens that most of those really great moments, for whatever reason, have come when he's been with the Eagles.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the Sixers quickly. Former L.A. Clippers coach Doc Rivers was out of work for about 5 minutes. He is now the new head coach for the Sixers. A good, fresh start, Mike?
Yeah, I like this hire a lot, Mary. You know, the big question the Sixers have to answer as they continue forward here is, what do they do about their two superstar players, Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons? Can those two players coexist? Can they play well together? Can the Sixers build a championship caliber team around them? That's still an open question. And Rivers is the kind of guy who will bring credibility to the organization. And he's going to act as something as a litmus test for these guys. If it doesn't work with Doc Rivers, with Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, then the answer, you know, the problem probably isn't Doc Rivers, because he's won a championship. He is respected around the NBA. He's a very good coach. So we're going to learn a lot about the two, you know, kind of centerpieces of the Sixers franchise here.
Are you missing Jimmy Butler after he put up 40
everybody
points?
Everybody in Philadelphia is missing Jimmy Butler, especially after last night. My gosh, 40 points. You know, he rallies the Miami Heat to win a game in the NBA Finals. I think the Sixers miss him. I think Philadelphia misses him. He was a fun player to watch and a fun player to cover.
Yeah. Catching up very quickly on when things might resume for the NBA and NHL. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver says, unlikely, at least for his group, there will be play until early 2021. That sound about right?
Yeah, it does sound about right. I mean, you don't even, you know, clearly you don't have to be paying attention to sports to know how quickly things can change where this virus is concerned. But I think the NBA is, you know, did a very good job of, you know, managing the situation within the bubble. The NHL certainly did. Major League Baseball got its bearings after some early, you know, problems. And I would argue, to be honest, Mary, that we need these institutions in some respect to kind of move forward. You know, we need to feel at least a little bit normal where we can. And I know that places a great burden on the athletes and the franchises and the people who operate them and own them. But I don't think it's a bad thing that these leagues try to do this, because I think in some small way it does help.
Back to the Phillies for just a sec. There were some exciting moments in the pandemic version of a season. But in the end, you know, if they'd gotten to play October baseball, Mike, they wouldn't have gotten far. They need a bullpen.
Oh, they need a bullpen and then some. I mean, you want to talk about the NFC East and the NFL being galactically awful. The Phillies bullpen took galactically awful to an entirely new level this past season. And it's why Matt Klentak is no longer the Phillies general manager. He could not find anybody, any relief pitcher who could pitch well for that team. And it's the reason they didn't make the playoffs.
Yeah,
and he was demoted. So that's got to be job number one, or at least job number 1A of the offseason. There's also the question of whether their catcher, JT Realmuto, who's regarded as the best catcher in the major leagues, is going to be back. He becomes a free agent this offseason.
And Didi Gregorius, too.
Yes, their shortstop, who had an excellent season for them, but only signed a one-year contract. So, again, another tough decision for the Phillies.
So in about 20 seconds, all things considered, how would you rate Joe Girardi's performance in his first season as manager for the Phillies?
I think Girardi was fine. I think similarly to what Doc Rivers is going to experience with the Sixers, we now know that the manager wasn't necessarily the biggest problem with the Phillies, no matter how much people around here might not have taken to Gabe Kapler during his 2 years with the Phillies.
All right, Mike Sielski, as always, great to have you with us on the Regional Roundup. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Mike Sielski is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And don't forget, we are there for you on social media. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Al Banks, our producer, John Ahrens, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for tuning in. Be well.